and once he got over the embarrassment of living with an unmarried girl in her father's home, he became good company, forever wanting to engage Mabbott in kitchen table debates. Mabbott, in turn, took a certain amount of pride in being able to extend a helping hand to the persecuted, and he had never seen his daughter happier. For himself, Mabbott had never thought of happiness as a natural state. To him, it was just the postponement of unhappiness. But now he was beginning to think rather differently. By accepting a looser, more general definition of the word, meaning things being not too bad for a significant amount of time, happiness was perhaps not such a far-fetched proposition after all. So, bit by bit, as the book crept forward and winter faded into spring, Mabbott came to accept the unfamiliar feeling of being, by and large, predominantly, content. Chapter 2. The last day of April was a Saturday, but Mabbott, as a point of pride, turned in the disc and a crisp hard copy of Melville, The Real Life of a Legend, one day early, on the last working day of the week. The hard copy had been Cilla's idea.
"I know it's old-fashioned, but I still think publishers like to see a book that actually looks like a book."
"Not Ron Latham's style, I wouldn't have thought."
"You'd be surprised. Ron's more impressed by tradition than you'd think."
Mabbott raised an eyebrow. "Well, here's to Hamish." The book had gone off to Urgent that morning, and Mabbott and Cilla were celebrating in Golding's, to which Cilla remained loyal, despite its almost perverse lack of glamour and its clientele of office workers and exhausted Oxford Street shoppers. Mabbott asked her about this, and Cilla admitted that with some of her clients she might have to go a little more upmarket.
"But not the ones I like."
She raised her glass of house carver with such genuine warmth that Mabbott felt an unaccustomed sense of closeness to this fierce, erratic, indomitable woman who'd guided his own erratic career with such loyalty.
"To Hamish. And to you, Keith."
Their glasses clinked. Two men from the postal depot next door, in to collect a takeaway, looked round. Celebration was a rare event at Golding's, especially at lunchtime.
"And to you, Sil, for everything."
They clinked again. To Mabbott's regret, the comely Croatian waitress had moved on, as they do, and in her place was an English girl, quite chubby, straight hair, thick mascara, into a West Country accent. She took their order abstractedly, staring out of the window, as if that was where the real world began. Cilla's mobile rang. She picked it up, and Mabbott reconciled himself to staring into space for a few minutes. But with a brief look at the caller's name, Cilla switched it off and dropped it into her bag.
"I don't want to be disturbed."
He'd never known her do this before. From the moment she'd given up smoking, the mobile had become Cilla's digital substitute, rarely, if ever, out of her hands.
"It might be Latham," he said, "wanting to know if we'd like the money in 20s or 50s.
Normally, he'd have expected an earthy laugh in response, but Cilla looked surprisingly serious. She leant back and stared briefly out of the window, before turning her eyes on him.
"You know, dear boy, that I don't do bullshit with you, so you have to believe me when I say that this is one of those moments when this whole shitty business seems worthwhile."
For the first time in a long while, Mabbott really looked at Cilla, at her broad prison warder's shoulders, the inverted triangle of holiday sunburn running down to a well-chosen cashmere sweater, her wide, round face, her hair taut at the forehead and descending in a skillfully dyed auburn mane. Though her skin tones were Scandinavian, everything else reminded Mabbott, suddenly, of the Gyara village and the women who lived below the sacred hill.
"I've had so many bad days, you know, Keith. I mean genuinely bad days when I had to sell crap to people. They know it's crap and I know it's crap, but neither of us can admit it because we all need the money. So when something like this comes along, totally out of left field, you have to thank whoever's up there for showing you there can be good days too."
"I never thought of you as having bad days, Sil. I thought that was just me." Cilla threw her head back and gave a bark of laughter.
"Oh, for God's sake, listen to the pair of us, Les Miserables."
Two portions of pasta arrived. Scylla brushed a wisp of hair from her eyes and called for two glasses of red wine.
"Large or small, madam?"
"Enormous."
She took two rapid forkfuls of pasta, dabbed at her mouth and pushed the bowl to one side.
"Believe it or not, Keith, when I started out all those years ago, I genuinely thought I could change things. That I wouldn't be one of those see you Monday, lunch at the club sort of agents. That I would go out there and find new authors. Go to universities and schools, even. Visit writers' groups. Find someone who had something fresh and original to say and help them say it. So that's what I did. I went out and looked and listened. But no matter what I did or who I found, there was always this undercurrent of disapproval. Why did I think it was more important to go to Newcastle to meet a new author when I should be at a book launch at the Savile Club? Especially as the author I was going to see had just completed 3 years for armed robbery.
Another hoot of laughter. The wine arrived. Scylla took a sip and let out a satisfied sigh.
Same old shit. I had to put up with all sorts of weird stuff in those days, Keith. That I was having affairs with all these boys and girls. That I was on some mission to corrupt the purity of the English language. At talent meetings, I'd be treated as if I was someone on work experience. Then came Abigail Morris. Do you remember her? Counting the Dead. Still one of the best books about the drug scene. True and honest. No bullshit. A one-hit wonder, as it turned out, but still a wonder. 100K in hardback, 200K in trade paperback, film options, foreign sales. And all at once I was taken seriously, given a partnership at Nathan Bowles and a nice fat expense account. Suddenly, everything seemed so easy. Why go bowling up to Glasgow on a wet Saturday evening when they could come to you? I did pretty well. I had a good table manner. I gave a good lunch.
Mabbott looked around at Goldings and grinned approvingly.
The money came in, good money. I bought a flat in Marble Arch, hired a chauffeur to take me shopping in Sloane Street. And I didn't really notice that the so-called authors I was bringing in were people just like myself. Successful people, leading the same successful lives. And as you know, there was and is an insatiable appetite for the lives of the successful. How they dress, where they eat, who they fuck, and where they go on holiday. None of which is very interesting.
She took a gulp of wine.
But being the nice, sociable gal I am, I listen to them and I encourage them, and the next thing I know, I'm the celebrity publisher's darling. The first port of call for overpaid footballers, models and chefs. And I'm persuaded, not that I took much persuading, to leave the agency and set up on my own, Scylla Corbell Associates.
She shook her head.
No, I didn't know I needed the associates either. I think it meant my mother. Anyway, along came the 90s and the economy went belly up and suddenly everyone was reining in, looking after number one, and of course it was only the big boys who had the money to ride it out.
Scylla drank again, swallowed and winced.
Those were the days before you knew me, Keith. And if you'd known me then, you'd probably have been ever so polite and raced off in the other direction. I was a loud-mouthed drunk, and I lost the will to give. I just took whatever was offered, and that included authors.
She threw back her head.
Anyway, out of the blue came Sir Galahad, Ronald Arthur Latham.
Ron Latham?
The same. He was going up, I was going down. We met on the stairs.
She held his gaze. Her eyes were defiant and apologetic at the same time.
Don't look so shocked, Keith. This is a story with a happy ending, remember?
She clinked his glass.
Ronald had his golfing stars and a budget to bring them in, but he didn't know how to deal with celebrities from the wider world. He wanted to learn from me, and he was the first person in a long time who'd wanted to do that. We spent a lot of time together. We got on pretty well, but ultimately we weren't the right gender for each other. And he was far too ambitious to want to come home at night and watch television. But I saw something of the younger me in him, and I was happy to see him succeed. In return, he looked after me, got me back on my feet. We did business together every now and then. Thanks to him, I was able to keep the brass plaque and the chauffeur, and I began to look around as I had in the old days. To find things that other people didn't. which is how I met you. I'd read your newspaper articles. I thought you could write. Remember? After the arsenic leak story? I knew then that you had something else in you.
So you put Ron Latham up to this? Scylla shook her head emphatically.
Ronald, for all his big talk, is one of nature's conservatives. I've been on to him for years to do something with some class. I've suggested subjects, but at the last minute he always plays safe. Then, out of the blue, this Melville idea comes up. And, stubborn as he can be, I knew that at last some of what I'd been banging on about had finally got through. So what prompted the Damascene conversion? Because he's done bloody well with his golfer's memoirs. He's made a lot of money, but I think now he wants his place in history. I know what you think of Ronald, but he's not that bad. He lacks charm because he lacks confidence, especially around people like you. Like me? A hack for hire? You've been to university. You've taught a creative writing course. He's always been embarrassed by what he thinks of as his lack of education.
Hardly seems to have done him much harm.
That's why I give him credit. I know you hate everything he stands for, but he's come good now.
Scylla drained the last of her red wine with a flourish.
Enough apologies. Ron's come good, and you've come good, and I've come good. I call it the Melville effect. Another glass.
When they parted, shortly after three, Mabbott felt lost. He crossed Tottenham Court Road. There were buses and trains that would have taken him home, but instead he followed a vaguely northerly route, walking through the back streets around the university, the big sober squares south of Euston Station. Something was nagging at him, and he needed time to pin it down. The fact was that beneath the elation of having completed the book, there was an element, quite a strong element, of fear. Fear that deep down nothing in his life had changed. That these last few months had merely been a happy aberration before normal service resumed. Sullom Voe, with all its compromises and inadequacies, had taken up almost 2 years of his life. The Melville book, during which he had rediscovered the joy of doing something relevant and valuable, hardly seemed to have started before it was over. It had brought satisfaction, but was it enough to change him permanently? Had it been enough to rout the despair gene, or whatever it is you do to genes? Mabbott found himself in Gordon Square. He remembered that Virginia Woolf had liked to sit in Gordon Square Gardens. Virginia, the doyenne of despair. He had read her diaries from cover to cover and advised all his students to do the same. Her books were classics. Yet for her, too, the fear of failure had been stronger than the solace of success. He carried on across Euston Road, past the British Library and the curious Levita House, an incongruous public housing block inspired by the architect's trip to Vienna in the 1930s. It had turned into one of those fresh spring evenings. A clear sky, a wind from the northwest, and even the most mundane buildings seemed dramatised by the evening sunshine. Mabbott noticed things he'd never seen before. A modern art gallery, tucked under a railway bridge in Kentish Town. A Somali barber's shop, full of tall, graceful men arguing fiercely. An old-fashioned ladies' dress shop, squeezed between two supermarkets. A young man grimacing wildly, being patiently accompanied down the road by what looked like a grandparent. His mind went back to India and the people he passed on the sacred slopes of the Masoka Hills. He'd been lucky enough to feel some sort of connection to these people, to be touched by lives so utterly different from his own. Which was another reason why, despite the long hours and the eye-aching research, he'd enjoyed writing the book so much. It was his way of paying something back to those whose way of life had been saved by Hamish Melville. He wandered along the back streets of Camden and Tufnell Park, and it was nearly six by the time he turned into Resserton Road. The house was quiet, and threatened to darken his mood, so, after a shower and a celebratory glass of wine, Mabbott scanned his notebook, found a number, and after a moment's pause, pressed call.
Hello? Hello, May.
For a moment there was silence. Then a voice, guarded at first.
Keith? How are you, May? Oh, I'm fine. Just fine. How are you?
I'm very happy, May.
That's good.
I just wanted to ring and tell you that. You used to worry about me.
Oh, aye. The despair gene.
He heard her laughter down the phone.
I'd be much better company now.
You were always good company, Keith. You were the only one who didn't think so.
I've finished a new book, and it's quite good. I'd like to send you a copy. See what you think.
Well, that'd be an honour indeed.
Outside he heard a booming noise, deeper and more resonant than the usual passing plane. It sounded like thunder.
I might bring it up to you, in person.
Are you serious?
Why not? I've handed it in today. I'm due a fair bit of money, so I could afford the crazy airfare. And I'd like to see you again.
What sort of book is it?
It'll be a surprise.
There's no oil terminals in it, then?
No. There's an aluminium refinery, though.
May laughed again.
Unputdownable.
There was a pause, as if neither of them knew exactly where to go from there.
I'd like to be up there with you, May, Mabbott said cautiously. I've been going stir-crazy here. Eyes locked on a screen, 12 hours a day.
Tell me about it.
A bit of Shetland's air is just what I need.
He realised that this had come out with more of a slur than he'd have liked.
You sound as though you're celebrating, Keith.
He peered out of the window. It had begun to rain, and two figures were racing across the street towards the house.
Now, how could you tell that, May?
With some relief, he heard her laughter again.
This, if you must know, is my first, Mabbott protested. Since 4 o'clock, that is. And the strange sound you can hear in my voice is happiness. And when I think of happiness, I think of you.
He heard a key in the front door.
I'd better go. I'll call you again, May, if that's all right.
Okay. Bye. And congratulations.
He put down the phone as his daughter and Shiraz came in from the hallway. They'd had one umbrella between them, and it didn't seem to have done much good.
You look cheerful, Dad. And dry. I am, my dear daughter. This has been a good day. How about you?
Jay threw down her bag and shook her wet hair. Mabbott, sensing something in the air, looked at Shiraz, who had collapsed the umbrella and laid it carefully by the door. The boy smiled back, politely, inscrutably, but Mabbott could see that something was bothering him. Jay headed for the kitchen.
Tea, Shiraz?
Yes.
Mabbott followed his daughter, rummaged in the kitchen drawer for a towel, then went back and handed it to Shiraz.
Sit down, you look tired.
Shiraz dabbed himself with the towel.
The news from home is not good.
Ah.
In the kitchen, the kettle began to hum. Mabbott looked at Shiraz expectantly.
What's happened?
After a moment, Shiraz spoke, quietly, almost reluctantly.
We have heard that two more of my family have been arrested. My uncle and my younger brother. We don't know where they've gone or what they have been charged with.
Despite the physical appearance of youth, there was a remarkable maturity about Shiraz. He was a tad serious, sometimes over-earnest, but bearing in mind the trauma he had endured, he remained remarkably self-assured. It was a characteristic he shared with Mahesh and Kinesh. And like them, he had brought Mabbott face to face with a very different kind of life. Jay had filled two mugs with tea, both, he noticed, bearing the imprint of the North Oil canteen at Solemn Vaux. She set one down in front of Shiraz, lightly brushing her hand through his hair as she did so. He made a quick movement away with his shoulders, which Mabbott noticed.
So you've heard the latest?
Jay asked her father.
Mabbott nodded. About the family. He's just told me. I'm really sorry.
The latest about Shiraz?
No.
He has to go before another review panel. If he doesn't get an extension, he'll be sent back.
Mabbott moved towards her and put a protective arm around his daughter's shoulders. She took a breath.
He'll be sent back.
She stopped, reached for a tissue, and blew her nose. Shiraz looked away, his expression showing a mixture of embarrassment and wounded pride.
I'm sorry, Jay blurted through her tears. This is so stupid.
There must be something we can do, Mabbott said soothingly.
I asked Rex to help. He knows all these people on committees and stuff.
Jay sniffed and reached for another tissue.
And? Well, you know, Mum's not seeing him as much. And if I try to ask her if he can do anything for Shiraj, she just sort of, well, she gets quite snappy. So I don't know.
She drew out the last word like a wail of desperation.
Look, I'll have a try, said Mabbott. I may have a contact or two myself. Whatever you can do, Dad.
In the meantime, is there anything I can do to help your family, Shiraj?
No, thank you, sir. You've been very kind already, letting me stay in your home.
Jay exchanged a glance with him.
There is something, she began.
Shiraj shook his head firmly.
What's that?
It's nothing, sir, thank you.
He rose.
I think I shall go and do some study. The immigration people will ask me many questions.
When he'd gone, Mabbott looked with concern at his daughter. He hadn't seen her like this for a long time. When the children were growing up, it was always Sam who had the crises.
Come on, love. What can I do? I can't tell you. He won't let me talk about it. He doesn't have to know.
Jay puffed out her cheeks. Her eyes were red-rimmed beneath the blotchy mascara. She cast a quick look out into the hallway, then spoke softly and urgently.
The only way that they can get any information about what's happened to his uncle and brother and where they've been taken is to pay money to the local prosecutor's office. Everyone does it, but Shiraj has this stupid male pride thing about being different from everyone else. He says paying bribes keeps a bad system going. But if it's that or never seeing your family again, what would you do?
How much does he need?
I don't know exactly. It's something like £2,000 for each of them. But it's no good. He won't take charity.
I'll give him 4,000.
He raised his hands, anticipating her reaction.
I want to. I'm in the money, darling. I handed in the book today.
Dad, you don't understand. There's a huge amount of pride involved. Just tell him it's a loan and he must pay every single penny back, or else.
Jay took his arm.
Are you sure?
Absolutely.
Then she giggled.
Down payment on the wedding, Dad.
What?
Well, you never know. I do adore him.
She left the room with a little skip of happiness. It was infectious. As Mabbott poured another glass of wine and pulled open the fridge, he marvelled at how different the world looked when you could give something back. From now on, he was going to stop worrying and learn to enjoy good fortune. He scattered a few biscuits in Stanley's dish, filled up his water, and settled down to watch football. Chapter 3. It was the start of the weekend, and Resserton Road was as quiet as the grave, save for Mabbott's exercise-obsessed neighbour, Grant, who emerged into the street in shorts and a tight yellow running vest. He rolled his head this way and that, stretched first one leg, then the other, against the low brick wall, then set off up the hill towards Archway. A milk float purred across the intersection, then all was quiet again. A short, sharp buzzing noise woke Mabbott from some rambling dream. He opened his eyes and squinted at the clock. It was 7:45. His first thought was one of surprise and pleasure. For the last 6 months, he'd have been well awake by now, worrying about the book. The phone rang again. He pulled himself up onto one elbow and picked it up. The voice was familiar.
Mr. Mabbott!
Mr. Latham.
Did I wake you? I was sort of dozing. What can I do for you, Ron? I've read your book. Oh, that was quick. I wasn't expecting. There's a lot of work to do.
Mabbott transferred the phone to his right ear.
I'm sorry? The book's not there yet. There's work to do. What do you mean? I've been putting in 18-hour days to finish it, Ron. You're the one who gave me the deadline. I can see you've put in the hours. It's impressive. India's very good. But it's a one-note book.
Mabbott was wide awake now. He pulled himself up and leant against the headboard.
What do you mean? I mean it's a one-note book. The guy's a saint.
With respect, Ron, I've met the man. I've worked with him. You haven't. I've spent 6 months researching every fact about him, meeting all his friends, talking to anyone who knew him. The fact that he comes out as a good guy doesn't mean I haven't done my job. It means he might be a good guy.
Calm down, Keith. I'm not disputing what you say. It's just that we have a lot of money riding on this, so we have a say as well. You know that. Your contract is very generous.
So, I got the man who has refused every biographer, every interview, for God's sake, for the past 40 years, to talk to me. Isn't that good value for money?
There was a shout from outside. A door slammed, and Mabbott heard footsteps briskly receding down the hill.
The book business has changed, Keith. A nice book about nice people doesn't sell because people don't want to know about nice people. Or if they do, they want to know that they've struggled to be nice. Had to sacrifice one of their children or ordered a contract killing. Stolen from their own mother on the way to becoming nice. Redemption justifies a lot, Keith. Melville comes across as Mr. Right from day one. Okay, he's a little unorthodox, doesn't brush his hair, sleeps on a hammock with the natives, turns down knighthoods, hangs out with guys who put pots on top of college spires. But that's about as non-nice as he gets. There is no light and shade, no dark side. It's a biography, Ron, not a lighting catalogue. And a dark side is what we need to shift this thing in the numbers we planned.
Mabbott caught sight of himself in the mirror. He was staring distractedly, like a hospital patient.
Why didn't you tell me this before I started? Then I could have lied, and we'd all be happy.
Steady on. What we asked for was a rounded picture. Every aspect of the man, remember? Those were my exact words.
I'm a journalist, Ron. I look for information that would lead me to the truth. That's what journalists do. If there were bad things, they would be in the book.
There was a brief pause. Mabbott could hear the sound of tea being sipped.
Your last book, Keith. The one about the oil terminal.
Mabbott frowned. What had that to do with anything?
I'm told it's pretty good.
Thank you, Mabbott replied cautiously.
North Oil must be pleased.
Yes, they like it.
I'll bet. No mention of the Brer disaster, I'm told.
Mabbott experienced a short, sharp convulsion.
That was pretty nasty. Thousands of tons of oil spilled. The Brer was nowhere near the terminal at the time. 30 miles away, it's not that far. But it had nothing to do with the terminal. Unlike the Esso Berenicia. That was very close to the terminal. In fact, a little too close. It smashed into a loading jetty, and there was no oil spill procedure in place. Clean-up cost the company $2 million, nearly 4,000 birds killed. Is that in your book?
Mabbott's brain was racing. There were no copies of the book around, apart from on his shelves and in North Oil's offices. How on earth had Latham got the information?
What's the point you're making, Ron? My point is, Keith, that it's horses for courses. I've no doubt that you, a campaigning journalist, would want to tell the truth about oil spills and fights with the council when they tried to protect their profit share. But the ball isn't always in your court, is it? The oil boys pay the piper. The piper plays the tune. What I'm getting round to is that you were paid, I'm guessing here, $15,000 all in. Plus expenses?
Astonishingly accurate.
To produce the book that North Oil wanted you to produce.
And?
If Urgent Books is paying you nearly $200,000... then surely you must feel some sort of obligation to produce the book we've asked you to produce.
Neither spoke for a moment. Mabbott tried to calm himself enough to give a sensible reply.
So what does Urgent Books want, Ron?
Why don't you come in and we can discuss it?
I'm happy to discuss anything. I can do Monday, this afternoon, 2 o'clock. I can't do that, Ron. I'm going to the football with Sam. It's the first time in weeks. I'll see you at the office.
Ring the night bell if there's a problem. Oh, and I've warned Scylla there might be a delay in the delivery payment. The phone went dead. Mabbott sat in a mess of bedclothes, trying to control his rage. Mabbott had decided that one of his top priorities, once he'd finished the book, would be to restore good relations with his son. There was a lot of ground to make up: sibling rivalries, maternal propaganda. The football had been his masterstroke. He and Sam hadn't been to a match together for years, and he'd lent on a few contacts to get tickets for the local derby with Tottenham. Tickets to die for. And there they were, in the kitchen, pinned up on the board in front of him. Latham was a cunt, an absolute cunt. He could bloody well take his money and shove it. Mabbott didn't need it. He got by before. All he wanted was never to see the man again. Jay appeared at the door. Behind her came Shiraj, his usual air of deep seriousness replaced by a cautious, almost embarrassed smile. He came towards Mabbott with his hands together in front of him. He gave a short bow, transferring his right hand to his heart.
"Believe me, Mr. Mabbott, as God is my witness, I do not deserve this."
He bowed his head again.
"But thank you. Thank you, sir. And may God bless you always."
Mabbott smiled uncertainly. He'd never seen Shiraj look so happy. Come to think of it, he'd never seen him happy.
"Jade told me what you offered to do last night. Believe me, your generosity towards my family will never be forgotten."
Jay took her father's arm and squeezed it.
"I am unhappy that this should be the way my country works. It is a far from perfect place, sir. But, God willing, with the help of people such as yourself, we can change things."
Shyly, tentatively, Shiraj held out a piece of paper.
"This is the bank here in London to which the money should be paid, and here is my full name and the name of the account. I am sorry to be so forward, sir, but time is of the essence."
Mabbott nodded, aware of Jay beside him and her hand on his arm.
"Thanks, Dad."
She reached up and kissed him. It was 1:30. Scylla's car had collected him 15 minutes earlier, but the traffic was bad because of the football, and Hector Fisher was not happy.
"Saga is not my game. Saga is a game for the proletariat. I'm a rugby man, Twickenham."
He gestured at the crowd streaming across the road towards the stadium.
"Look at these people. They are the common herd."
But Mabbott wasn't listening. He was still in shock. He spoke to Scylla in a muttered whisper.
"What does he mean, one note? He's a golf publisher, for God's sake."
"Was."
"He doesn't understand people. All Ron understands is a business model."
Scylla sighed.
"I'm sorry," Mabbott went on. "I know you and he, but, I mean, you've read the book."
"I skimmed it, old boy, and I thought it was great. I loved the India stuff. But Ron would have gone through it with a fine-tooth comb. He'd have been up all night. That's the way he works."
"Maybe he'll be asleep when we get there."
Scylla gave a short, hollow laugh.
"Some hope." "You know what they do, these people," said Hector, sensing a break in the conversation. "They take a newspaper, roll it up, and wee-wee into the pocket of the man in front of them, and he to the man in front of him. At Twickenham, nobody pees on anybody."
Mabbott looked out of the window. The sea of red and white scarves was a painful sight. He called Sam twice, left messages about the tickets, but had heard nothing. Sam knew all about the weapon of silence. It was 2:00 when they turned off Southwark Bridge Road and into the car park of Urgent Books. It being a Saturday, there was no one on the gate, but there was notification of an emergency number to ring. By the time the barrier had been raised and the rising curbs lowered, a further 5 minutes had elapsed. Hector dropped them off at a side door which led into the glass and marble reception area, empty save for an Asian man wearing purple overalls who was making slow, sweeping passes over the marble floor with a rotary polisher. Ron, looking fresh and sharp in navy polo shirt and jeans, called down to them from the gallery above.
"First floor, coffee's on. Lifts out of action."
As they climbed the strangely old-fashioned, curving staircase, Mabbott slowed down, aware that his pace was a lot faster than Scylla's. When she reached the top of the stairs, she had to stop for a moment to get her breath.
"You all right, Scylla?"
"Fine, thanks, old boy. Stairs are best when they go down, I find."
Latham picked up coffees from the dispenser and carried them towards his office. He gestured at the lines of unattended workstations and sadly shook his head.
"Never understood weekends myself."
In the office, he motioned to two leather chairs, then settled down behind his desk. Through the window, Mabbott caught a glimpse of light reflecting off the distant Thames, and it gave him some hope. Latham snapped the blind shut.
"Sorry about that. It's the only problem with this office. Let's in the sunshine."
"Have you any water, Ron?" Scylla asked.
Mabbott looked over at her. She seemed to anticipate his concern and made a rude face, which partly reassured him. Ron reached into a fridge and found a small bottle of water. The manuscript lay open on the desk, and Mabbott could see Ron's scribbled notes, even on the title page, for God's sake. Ron licked his forefinger and turned the pages back and forth.
"Okay, guys. You know my problem with this. It's well written."
He looked across at Mabbott as if this were his first big mistake.
"And if I were Melville's mother, or the head of Amnesty International, this would press all the right buttons."
Scylla gave a short, involuntary cough. Mabbott caught her eye. Latham leant back, interlocking his fingers.
"You've been on the oil rigs for too long, Keith. Lost your sense of perspective."
Mabbott opened his mouth to protest, but no words came. Latham assaulted a few more pages before picking up the manuscript in both hands as if weighing it.
"If you don't mind my saying so, this is like a note to a new lover."
Mabbott coloured. Scylla stared at Latham. He met her eyes briefly, then they both looked away.
"All right," Latham continued. "I've made my point. I'm not going to say any more other than this is not a book I can recommend to my board."
Mabbott felt very weary, like a man slipping back into quicksand when all but the tips of his toes were clear.
"Look, all I did was fulfill everything I had been asked to do. Believe me..."
Latham leant forward and raised one finger.
"Yet."
Mabbott paused.
"What?" "This is not a book I would recommend to my board... yet."
Scylla coughed again. It sounded worse this time. Ignoring her, Latham went on.
"There are things that can be done."
Mabbott rolled his eyes.
"I have covered the ground, Ron. I've talked to 30, 40 people. I've followed up every lead. This is not a portrait I dreamt up myself. This is a consensus. I'm sorry if you don't like it, but that's the way it is."
Latham tapped a key and looked at his computer.
"With all due respect, Keith, I think there may be some stones that remain unturned. I asked the boys and girls in my research team to look at some of the grey areas again, and yes, here we are."
He pressed another key, and a printer began to hum.
"They've come up with something you might have missed."
He pushed his chair along the desk and retrieved two newly printed sheets of paper. He held one out to Mabbott and one to Scylla.
"This, in my humble opinion, is worth pursuing. I don't need to tell you both that it's highly confidential information. It just might be the sort of thing our book needs."
Chapter 4. When they reached Scylla's apartment building, Hector had to help her from the car. Apart from delivering a short diatribe about Japanese tourists wearing face masks,
"Who's sick, us or them?"
he had been strangely subdued as they drove home. Mabbott and his agent had barely spoken, and for once, Hector seemed to catch the mood. Mabbott held open the brass-handled doors as Scylla, resisting any form of support, straightened up and walked into the lobby.
"Are you sure you're okay?"
"Yes, I'll be fine. It's just some kind of flu-y headache."
"Do you want me to come up?" Scylla shook her head vigorously.
"No, no, no, dear boy. Quite unnecessary. I shall have a hot toddy, go to bed and watch The X Factor. I'll be fine in the morning."
Mabbott pressed the lift button.
"What's his game, Scylla? What's this all about?"
"How should I know, old boy?
He has people on his back, urgent to put a lot of money behind this project, and they want something that'll be talked about. It's the way the business is, believe me. And he may be right. There could be something you've missed. No one's perfect, not you, not Melville. Should I do what he says? No option, dear boy. The publisher's approval clause is a tough one. They can lead you round the ring for a lot longer. She suddenly looked very drained, but managed a wan smile. Don't sulk, darling. 6 months ago you couldn't believe your luck. Now you're behaving like Ernest Hemingway.
The lift slid down in front of them. Talk in the morning. Scylla nodded, and with a peremptory little wave, she stepped into the lift. Mabbott was aware of Hector's pumped-up frame filling the doorway behind him.
She don't look well.
No.
I drive her 4 year. I never see her look like that.
Mabbott nodded agreement.
Once I drive another lady, much younger, always laugh. Then one day she don't come down.
Well, I'm sure she'll be fine.
Dead. 2 days dead. I had to break in. She was 51.
That's sad.
Oh, yes. Sad. Where you go now? The place you live?
No, I've some shopping to do. For some reason, Hector winked.
Okay, sir. I understand.
He gestured towards the lift.
Look after the lady. She's a good woman.
Mabbott walked away from Scylla's block and took a turning that led to a small garden dominated by an expansive London plane tree. It was tucked away, a relic of an 18th-century churchyard, and few people seemed to know it was a public place. A woman and her daughter were feeding a flock of fat, fidgety pigeons. Two Asian girls in headscarves sat on one of the benches, giggling. Otherwise, people passed by without stopping. Mabbott found a wooden bench, as far away as possible from the others. He leant back against the words, in memory of Mifanwi Dell, who loved this place, and took out the sheet of paper Latham had given him. At the top, in bold, was the name and address of one Victor Trickett, Sir Victor Trickett. Latham must have cut and pasted the rest of the contents, presumably from his researcher's report. Therefore, following extensive inquiries, we have ascertained that this is the same man who had dealings with Melville back in the early 80s, an episode which does not reflect well on Mr. Melville. VT has agreed to talk to your author, provided his identity is protected. He has never spoken about his relationship with Mr. Melville before, but he's now ready for a... something cut out here... to put the record straight before it's too late. We recommend that the author make contact with a view to a visit ASAP. At the bottom of the page, Latham had added, in his own handwriting, "Strongly recommend follow-up. For any help with arrangements, contact me personally, 24/7, RL. Mabbott folded the note and slipped it into his inside pocket. A strengthening wind rustled the branches of the tree that sheltered him. The last month spent crisscrossing the country in search of contacts, doing research in libraries and news archives, had reminded him why he had once been good at his job. He was thorough. He took pride in following up every lead, knocking on every door, making sure he missed nothing. Now, apparently, he had missed something significant, and an all too familiar feeling returned, that sudden swinging collapse in morale to which he seemed so fatally susceptible. He read and reread the single sheet of paper. There was something that worried him about it. It was not so much that it showed him up, or even that it had appeared so late in the game, collected by some anonymous figure from an equally anonymous informant. What made him suspicious was the apparently uncritical way that Latham had endorsed these findings. His shifty, conspiratorial, contact me personally approach smacked of something more than a mere desire to get at the truth. If there was a separate agenda to rake up bad news on Melville, then perhaps Mabbott's failure to find it was less culpable. The difference between honest and dishonest reporting. A light rain began to fall, marking a circle of dry ground beneath the shelter of the tree. A smartly dressed woman hurried by, holding her dog as if she were afraid of it getting wet. The Asian girls stood and walked cautiously out of the park. They checked their mobiles. One gave a high-pitched squeal, and they set off rapidly up the street.
Hi, Dad.
Mabbott shut the front door, dropped his bag to the ground and made wearily for the kitchen. Jay and Shiraj were at the table, cups of tea in front of them, eating something wholesome from foil containers, similar in shape and size to those that littered the approach to his underground station every Saturday night. Did they like the book? Mabbott stopped himself from telling the truth just in time.
Pretty much.
There's a few things they want me to look at before it's all signed and sealed. How about you? Had a good day?
Yes, really good.
Jay smiled and reached for Shiraj's hand.
I was able to speak with my mother and my cousins this afternoon, and they are all very happy and send blessings to you for helping us in our time of trouble.
Mabbott cleared his throat and unhooked a mug from above the worktop.
I won't be able to get it straight away, I'm afraid. They're delaying the delivery payment.
Jay's face clouded.
But you've delivered the book.
Technically, yes. But they want some new interviews to be done. It'll take another week or so. Jay looked embarrassed. Shiraz shook his head and, turning to her, spoke softly.
It's fine, Jay. I will tell them.
Mabbott still had his coat on. He turned and went out into the hall to hang it up. By the time he came back, he'd made up his mind. Of all those around him at the moment, Jay was the least compromised, the one most open and dependent on him. This was the one family relationship he had not messed up, and most of his debts had been paid off.
Don't worry, Shiraz. I'll authorize a transfer right away. The money should go through first thing Monday.
Please, sir, I do not want to take from you what I cannot pay back. Believe me, my family will honor any amount you can find for us. You have already given me your hospitality and your friendship. This will never be forgotten.
Mabbott looked to Shiraz. His troubles were of a far, far greater magnitude than anything Mabbott had ever had to deal with. These were matters of life and death, and yet the boy accepted them all with a stoical calm. Whatever urgent books wanted was insignificant compared to what might befall Shiraz or his family. He felt not only a warmth for the decent young man his daughter had brought into his life, but also gratitude for the opportunity he had been given to right some wrongs. He extended his hand. Shiraz stood, and as he did so, Mabbott reached out and hugged him close. Chapter 5. Sir Victor Trickett wasn't easy to find. His address, Lees Hall, had no accompanying number. Only the name of the village where it was located, Great Brenham, Norfolk. Mabbott had taken the Norwich train, hired a car, and had already got lost twice as he negotiated the back roads where signposts were still shaped like pointing fingers. Great Brenham was the largest of a cluster of villages that also included Little Brenham, Brenham Till, and Brenham Magister. Though it had once boasted three medieval churches, the present-day population of the Brenhams was probably in the low hundreds. The only thing approaching a centre was a small village green with a single multi-purpose shop. Mabbott received directions to Lees Hall from the elderly proprietor.
"Has been empty for quite a while," she added encouragingly.
Mabbott bought a steak pie and ate it sitting in the car. As he stared out at the two or three flintwork cottages with their creeper-clad walls, he found himself hoping beyond hope that this would be a bum lead. He tidied away the remnants of the crumbling pie, took a swig of water, then scrutinised the directions he'd been given and turned on the engine. A mile or so down a country lane, a track led off between stony fields until it dipped and entered a small wood. He slowed down when he came to a timber pile marked on the map, and a few yards beyond that was a stout but mildewed five-bar gate, securely fastened. He got out of the car and was examining the rope knots, when he heard a voice and the gruff bark of a dog.
"I'll do that."
Down the overgrown driveway came a short, barrel-like figure. The man was wearing a beret and a trench coat, and looked to Mabbott to be about his age. An elderly retriever shuffled along behind him.
"You must be Mabbott."
On closer inspection, the man was clearly much older than his visitor. His skin, though firm, was deeply lined and mottled around the neck. He had a thick grey moustache, and wisps of white hair curled out from beneath the beret. On the front of it was a badge which caught Mabbott's eye.
18th Royal Hussars. Light Dragoons, they call them now.
The man's voice was harsh and croaky, his tone petulant. The classic outsider, thought Mabbott, as he watched the man work deftly through the knots and slip the rope over the gatepost.
You can bring the car in. Just be careful of the dog. She's half blind.
Lees Hall was little more than a large Victorian villa. Ivy grew across its plain red brick facade, and with the woods hemming it in on three sides, there was a sense that nature was close to reclaiming the space. There was one open aspect, through which could be glimpsed a low hill, on top of which were what looked like outbuildings.
"Used to be a farm,"
said the man, who Mabbott had to assume was Victor Trickett. He led Mabbott through a porch into a large dark hallway that smelt of dogs and damp.
"Want a beer?"
Mabbott declined. "Do you have any coffee?" he asked.
"No."
"Tea, perhaps?" There was an unmistakable hiss of exasperation.
"Bag, Doom?"
"That's fine."
"You should find one in the cupboard."
He indicated a long, narrow kitchen off the hallway.
"Above the basin. Kettle's full."
His voice receded, and Mabbott found himself alone. A fine layer of grease on the kitchen surfaces put him off any further exploration. Checking that he wasn't being observed, Mabbott emptied and refilled the kettle, then selected a mug, washed it carefully, and set it down on the one empty space on the worktop.
"So what do you want to know?"
The voice came from a room next to the kitchen. Mabbott peered through the door and found his host in a cluttered drawing room, which was full of good-looking furniture, but too like the back room of an antique shop to be completely comfortable. Trickett settled himself into an armchair and poured a bottle of beer into what looked like a regimental mug.
"I haven't got long,"
he said to Mabbott. The kettle was barely whispering, so Mabbott abandoned the idea of tea and perched himself on the edge of a chair, reaching into his pocket for the voice recorder. "Do you mind if I use one of these?"
"Rather not."
"It's purely for accuracy. Protects you as much as it protects me."
"Don't you people have notebooks?"
"I use one of those as well. The recorder's just for backup."
"Notebook will do me."
Mabbott put away the recorder and took out his pad and a blue pentel. "You're certainly off the beaten track here."
"Suits me."
Mabbott cleared his throat. "Sir Victor, I believe you know Hamish Melville."
"Used to. Haven't seen him in years."
This proved to be the tone of much of their conversation, Mabbott having to prod, Trickett playing it straight back. He claimed they'd met in the army, where Melville was a captain in the Royal Engineers. That, at least, corresponded with Mabbott's own research. Both had been involved in the Suez invasion of 1956, and both were highly critical of the way the operation had been bungled. They kept in touch. Neither of them had been tempted by Civvy Street, both by nature a touch stroppy. Then, without warning, Melville had left the army and started to make money in the city. Trickett had stayed on in the Hussars for a while, but seeing how well Melville and some other ex-soldiers were doing, he too had resigned his commission and gone into business. Melville was a wheeler-dealer, had good,
what they called, people skills.
Trickett admitted he was the opposite, an inventor, someone who was happiest at the drawing board or in the lab. In the early days of heart surgery, he had worked on a pioneering set of MHVs, mechanical heart valves, and was experimenting with a new type of plastic valve. Development was expensive, however, and he had approached his old colleague Melville to come in as a partner. To get this far had taken a couple of beers, and it was when Trickett returned with a third that the story took a very different turn. "Did the partnership come to anything?" Trickett wiped a finger across his upper lip before he spoke.
"Yes, but not exactly as I'd hoped."
His voice had lost some of its military briskness, and for the first time he seemed a touch unsure of himself. The dog wandered in and sniffed the air before collapsing at his master's feet.
"I've never spoken about this,"
Trickett began, looking up sharply at Mabbott.
"And your people did promise me that..."
"My people?"
"The chap who rang. Said he was working for you."
For a moment, both men looked confused. Trickett made to get up.
"I wrote the name down somewhere. I can find it for you."
Mabbott motioned for him to stay in his chair.
Anyway, I made it clear to this chap that I didn't want to be named.
Any special reason?
I'm a very private man, as you can see. I'm not interested in settling any scores. But if a story is to be told, then it should be the truth.
Absolutely.
Well, I'll tell you. Hamish and I fell out over a woman. It seems no big thing nowadays, but it cost me a lot of money and a great deal of credibility. At the time, my wife was also my colleague. She was Yugoslavian, Slovenian. She'd heard about my work on the anginal valves and was doing similar work herself. So, we corresponded. I went over to Ljubljana to meet her. Well, we became...
Trickett cleared his throat, and his eyes went down to the carpet.
We became very fond of each other. Bettina came to London in 1976, and we married the following year. She was a clever woman, and she was beautiful.
He gave a short, rueful laugh.
I didn't really stand a chance. I had my head down, literally, going over the designs again and again, testing and retesting, to prove beyond a shadow of doubt that they would work. Bettina was doing the work alongside me, but she was less single-minded than me. She liked to mix work and play.
The dog let out a sudden high-pitched exhalation and stretched its legs out across the carpet. Trickett did something similar, pulling himself up, bracing his shoulders, and looking Mabbott full in the eye. When he spoke, the military precision had returned.
To cut a long story short, Melville seduced her, and took from me not only my wife but the money we'd invested in the development of the